Hi, I'm Farida Mashok, and I'm 9 years old.
Hi, I'm Delilah Quinnishtada Sabota, and I'm 8 years old.
And you're listening to the International Women's Day Special with Sharon Sabota
at KPFA 94.1 FM.
And online at kpfa.org.
This old face has seen a few days of blazing red joy, days of blue, and every line etched in deep by sand that slipped through, not mine to keep.
Good evening. This is a special International Women's Day edition of the Weekend Evening News. When we hear about police-involved killings, we sometimes forget about those who are left behind, particularly the moms, the children, the siblings, the community members, and in the case of George Perry Floyd, the aunt. Today we'll spend most of the hour with Angela Harrelson, the aunt of George Perry Floyd, and the author of Lift Your Voice, How My Nephew George Floyd's Murder Changed the World. But we begin with the voices of moms who are now helping to raise and guide a generation of children who are missing a mother or a father, while continuing to fight for justice in a world that is embedded with intersectional systems of oppression.
My name is Wanda Johnson. I'm the mother of Oscar Grant that was killed January 1st, 2009 at the Fruitvale BART station by Johannes Meserle.
So if Oscar Grant was alive today, he would be turning 37. On Monday, he might be a barber. He'd be a grandpa. What else would he be doing?
Oscar would be encouraging me, and we would be going together, doing what God had called us to do together. And that would be ministering to people, encouraging people, pushing people forward in their journeys, letting them know that they can be successful and that they could do anything through Christ who strengthens them.
So he's now been gone well over a decade, and you're still fighting hard and maybe fighting harder than ever. What keeps you going?
Definitely through prayer, through the community, through seeing mothers' faces and seeing them strengthen in their power, their lost loved one, helps me to keep going.
And sometimes when people think about police brutality or police-involved killings, they think about the young men who often die, sometimes women, but often men or non-binary folks sometimes. How is it a women's issue?
When we still see the killing of young men unnecessarily at the hands of police, it brings tears to my eyes to see that we still have a long way to go. That dream, the very dream that Martin Luther King had and was fighting for equality, we're still fighting some years later for that same thing. And it hurts to see mothers suffering from the loss of their loved one at the hands of those who were hired and protected to serve us.
My name is Rhonda Dormis.
And you're from?
Baltimore, Maryland.
And you're wearing a shirt that says, Say Her Name. Tell me about it.
Say Her Name is a representation of women who have been killed across the United States by law enforcement. It's an organization that uplifts women and makes women less marginalized than the male counterparts that are always in the forefront when it comes to police brutality.
And how did you personally get involved?
I was personally involved when August 1st, 2016, my 23-year-old daughter, Corinne Gaines, was gunned down by law enforcement SWAT team, Royce Ruby, after a standoff when she refused to leave her home, after her home was breached by keys for a traffic violation that just went left. And so it was a 6-hour standoff, and about the 6th hour, the officer decided he didn't want to wait anymore, and he shot my daughter, Corinne Gaines, through the wall. He couldn't see her by his own admission. He shot her through the wall in the back, not only killing her, but injuring my 5-year-old grandson, who was shot twice by shrapnel, or hit by shrapnel. And then he proceeded to enter the house and shoot her 4 more times, sent a mass while she was already down. This was all witnessed by my grandson.
And was your grandson her child?
Yes, my grandson Cody Gaines was Corinne Gaines' son. She also had a 14-month-old daughter who happened to not be there during the shooting that I am now raising.
So are you raising both of your grandchildren?
No, my grandson's father happens to have him. Okay. And I have my granddaughter who's now 8. She was 14 months when her mom was taken, and she was still breastfeeding. So I acquired a child who never had a bottle, who was, like, again, used to breastfeeding and being under her mother. And it was a challenge initially, but now I couldn't imagine anything more than raising her. She keeps me sane. She gives me purpose. You know, outside of this fight for justice and fight for change, my granddaughter is who keeps me alive, because she gives me a reason to motivate myself to even get out of the bed every day.
So many of us never had a chance to know your daughter, right. But what would you like people to know about her?
Well, she was a 23-year-old. She was an entrepreneur. She owned her own properties. She was owned a hair salon, part ownership in a hair salon. She did a lot of things at the age, before the age of 23, that a lot of people still haven't accomplished. She was well-traveled. She was well-read. A mother of 2 amazing children that she put in the front. She just loved them to pieces. Amazing daughter, amazing sister. She was just an amazing person to have in your life. And so the family and all of our families have been ripped apart by our losses. We get together like this to kind of absolve the feeling of feeling left out in a world where people really don't understand what this loss is like.
My name is Gwen Carr. I'm the mother of Eric Garner, and I came here to stand in solidarity with Miss Wanda Johnson.
And you also lost a son.
Yes, my son was Eric Garner. He was killed by NY police officers in 2014. And ever since then, I've been advocating. We know that it's too late for my son, but we have to advocate for the living and hope that there's no more killings.
And what's kept you going all this time?
What keeps me going is my faith. And I always galvanize with women who understand my pain, and I can understand their pain. And we can talk about it. We can encourage each other. We can embrace and enlighten each other on different issues. So that keeps me going. My family, they keep me going because they always stay in contact and try to keep me motivated to keep doing this work.
The world knows about how Eric died a little bit, but tell us about how he lived. Who was he?
Eric was a gentle soul. He was my firstborn. He loved life. He loved his children. He loved his mother. And we had such a great relationship, even as an adult. He was my baby. And he was a lover of Christmas. He was a lover of football, the Giants in particular. And he was just a person that he loved everybody. He loved people. Everybody was his friends, he thought. And I'm just missing him so much. I will never stop missing him.
So my name is Gail Hall, and I'm from Washington, D.C., and the police killed my son, Vito Hall, on May the 24th, 2021.
How old was your son at the time?
Vito was 26.
What were the circumstances?
How do I make a long story short? Vito was going through a mental crisis. He had a gun, and the police shot him when... allegedly, my son brandished the gun.
What would have happened if during your son's mental health crisis, he had a different kind of intervention? What could that have looked like?
Like I've seen it look like for Caucasian men who have guns and shoot people up and they come out arrested. So what it would have looked like is that, you know, he didn't even shoot anyone. So he had a gun and he brandished it. And so if you had shot him in the leg, or, you know, something not as lethal as shooting him in the face, you know, he might be doing some time in jail, right? Would he still be alive? I could visit him. I could talk to him. You know, that's what it could have looked like, because that's what it's looked like for
white men.
Other people, for white men.
What was your son like as a person?
I like that. Vito was funny. He was shy. But once he got to know you, he would talk and laugh. He was real cool, easygoing. And he loved his culture, and he knew a lot about his culture. And he was always teaching, you know.
What was his dream?
To just be a good dad, a good person.
He had children.
Yes, he had a 4-year-old son at the time. So his son is 5 now. His aspiration, you know, to work and be a responsible dad and, you know, be a family man.
And so when you look back at your son's legacy, what do you want people to take away from this tragedy? And what keeps you going? As you're talking about him, you're smiling a little bit.
I would like law enforcement to help all people. The same grace and mercy that you show to one race, show to all races. That's the biggest takeaway. But I don't know if that'll ever happen in this lifetime.
Do you believe it could?
No.
No.
I think racism is so deep.
So embedded.
And I think that the police force is so, you know, it was created not for us. It was created against us.
But you're still fighting and you're still standing strong. What keeps you going?
I saw a post I never forget, and it's like in my heart. Do what you can, when you can, if you can, while you can.
I'm Farida Mashok, and I'm 9 years old.
Hi, I'm Delilah Quinnestata Sabota, and I'm 8 years old.
And you're listening to the International Women's Day Special with Sharon Sabota
at KPFA
94.1 FM
and online at kpfa.org.
It's been 1,020 days since George Perry Floyd died under the knee of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. If you go to Minneapolis to the area in front of the infamous Cup Noodle on the corner of East 38th and Chicago Avenue, where the world watched George Floyd take his last breath, it has now grown into a sprawling memorial, both for George Floyd and for others in the community who've lost their lives to police or community violence. It also has artwork, sculptures, a gas station that's been transformed into a community gathering space, a greenhouse, a free bookstore, a free clothing store, and a community coffee shop, affectionately referred to as the George Floyd Hub. If you go to the sprawling memorial, which is considered to be one of the longest-standing memorial protests in U.S. history, in addition to a dedicated group of community members, you're likely to find Angela Harrelson. Harrelson is a nurse who specializes in helping people with substance abuse issues, and she has a rich backstory of resiliency of her own. But since her nephew's death, she's now become an activist in the fight for racial justice in a world that she hopes will someday be free of police violence. She's also the author of Lift Your Voice, How My Nephew George Floyd's Murder Changed the World.
My name is Angela Harrelson. And I live in Minneapolis. I am George Floyd's aunt. His mother is my sister.
Talk about how many siblings were in your family and where,
oh my goodness.
Where
oh,
you are in the pecking order.
I come from a family of 14. My mom did lose one shortly, a few months after birth. And there were 10 girls and there were originally 4 boys. And we was all born and raised in North Carolina, a small town called Goldsboro, North Carolina. And my parents were pretty much sharecroppers.
Angela describes one of her older sisters, who's also the mother of George Perry Floyd.
Sister is one of the older siblings. She pretty much took Perry when he was about like 5 years old, and they migrated to Houston. And Sissy, you know, she often lived with us. Sissy, you know, because Sissy spent most of her life as a single mom. She did get married, but it was a hard marriage. Things didn't work out. So she ended up raising Perry and the 2 girls.
At times, George Floyd, along with some of his siblings and his mother, traveled to different parts of the country. But Angela says they always made their way back to North Carolina to be with the family.
Perry's father, who he was named after, George Perry Floyd, Sr. So that's where he gets the name from. But they always came to North Carolina because Perry, the father, Perry Sr., I just say Perry Sr.
Okay.
Father was from North Carolina as well. Everybody from North Carolina. But they always came home. And, you know, when Sissy fell on short times, they always came home to live with us.
That home was a humble place that was filled with love.
Most all of the sisters always came home to live with us. And I'm thinking, for the life of me, you know, we live have an outhouse here.
Right.
we live like in a shack, you know, really bad house. They probably would condemn that house. They eventually did. You know, when that's all you know, you do the best you can. But when I got older, I realized that people didn't come back because it was a condemned house or because then, you know, they weren't thinking about the outhouse. It was the love and the family and the reunion and the good food and the cooking. That's what it was all about.
That's beautiful. And that comes through a lot in your book, which is amazing. I think you're such a humble person. And I was blessed that when I was at George Floyd Plaza visiting the coffee shop, you and I talked and you didn't mention the book, but it's very riveting. And my children are 8 and 11, and we've been reading it before bed. And one of the things that they were really struck by was the story. You mentioned that one of the siblings didn't make it very long. And it sounds like your parents had encountered a landowner that was very racist and maybe had a confrontation and had to leave with the baby. And,
you know, I heard about that, even though I was nowhere near born at that time. This is like up in the upper elders. But my mother constantly told that story. She told it from the point of like any mother that lost a child. You know, even though people say, oh, my mother got 13 kids left, it didn't really matter to her if she had 10 girls and 3 boys left. In her heart, she always, always grieved the loss of that child. Frank Jones was his name, Frank. My father was a very, very rough man and didn't really have a lot of patience for a lot of stuff. Now, my mother was born in 1925. So how they were raised up in the 20s and the 30s, can you imagine that time period? And my father was much older. And I guess apparently, to make a long story short, apparently my father refused to work. My mom think he just got fed up with something. And I believe the man used the N-word, call him a nigger. And in those days, if you didn't work, you have to get out if you were sharecropped. They didn't have time to do all of that. So my mom, you know, wrapped the baby up as warm as she could, and they had to walk. And I mean, my mom telling me that they walked the babies. I'm not sure how far her parents lived, but she made it there with the baby and the rest of the little kids. And so, but unfortunately, the baby got sick. It wasn't strong enough to handle that. And so the baby didn't make it.
How many children, other than baby Frankie, were with?
There were probably maybe like 4 or 5 of them, you know, at that time. So this is much older.
It was a big family.
It was a big family. But baby Frankie didn't make it. My mom said he was the most beautiful baby. But my mom said it with all the babies. But she remembered his long hair. And so he had a very, very beautiful long piece of strand of hair that she always would like put on his forehead because it was so long. And she said the baby, I remember she said he died right on my shoulder, Angela. She said she knew. She said the baby cried all night long. And all night long, she put him in his shoulder. She tried to comfort the baby. What medicine they gave back in that time, they tried to give the baby. It was very devastating, but she blamed that man.
Yeah. And also racism and the structures of it are entrenched in your family. You said your great-grandfather was right?
Well, yeah, my great-grandfather was born a slave. His name was Hillary Thomas Stewart Sr., you know, and his son, Hillary Thomas Jr., the junior, is my mother's dad. And he got his free papers when he was 8 years old. And so all the information was passed along to the family to make sure we knew who we were and where we come from.
Tragic story and beautiful that you're keeping the story alive. Sometimes people say the act of telling a story is an act of resistance.
It is, because you have to continue to tell the story, because sometimes I think white supremacy wants us to forget, or rewrite the story the way they want to see fit. And so, you know, you run across people. Matter of fact, I think I did most recently run across someone, she didn't know who I was. Slavery's over, get over it. And people don't realize, well, that has always been the problem, because when you say that, you don't want to even acknowledge it when they say that. And I heard that all the time, you know, that happened. It was over in 1865, get over it. But not realizing, well, we're still dealing with the consequences of slavery through structural and systemic racism. So when people often ask you to get over it, you're doing the best you can. I have to work twice as hard I can't walk in a jewelry store and look around without somebody's on my back. You know, I have to be careful everything that I do. And they don't realize or they don't care that we're dealing with the consequences of it. And white supremacy is dealing with the benefits of slavery. And, you know, and so it's something that could have been prevented, that have people worked so hard to keep people oppressed. And that's, it takes a lot of work to do that.
Right. Yes.
I mean, honestly, I mean, to keep a certain people oppressed, and not just Black, but you have the Native Americans, you know, immigrants and things like that. You know, and when I say white, I'm not talking about all white people, I'm talking about the white supremacy.
Of course.
I just want to make that sure. And so, and I'm like, I say to myself sometimes, if they would have spent as much of their hard work working on unifying people, making it not just equal for all, if they could have took that much work for 400 years, do you know how better this country would be?
Absolutely. And in your story, you also are a nurse and you work with people with chemical dependencies.
Mm-hmm. So
I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how you got there. You started in this very sort of poverty-stricken house that was full of love and then went in the path.
Yeah, at the end of a statistic, you know. Well, you know what? I tell you, my mom had us 13 kids raising us. Her dream for us was just to get a high school diploma. She could not see college because that was too far out of her reach, but she could see high school because she never had a high school diploma. Neither of my parents did. I think they quit school around the sixth grade or something, but that was their dream for us. But she was determined to make sure that the best that she could, that we get that high school diploma. But to see the determination and the willpower and the strength was passed along, those genetic internal traits were, I believe, passed along from her father and then from her grandfather, who was my great-grandfather, Hillary Thomas Stewart Sr., who was born a slave. And I think when it comes to a lot of Black people, when you don't have anything else, you depend on a lot of faith. And a lot of us become spiritual, depend on God, power to get us through. And somehow that becomes our vision. And we could see this vision in our heart, our mind, and our soul, even though we don't have it. And we take that in here and we keep pushing through because we don't have a choice. And those values are what took me through. I got picked on. I got bullied. Oftentimes, I didn't have a lot of friends come over because of the way I lived. And the shame of them and things like that happen. But we learn to push through.
Angela Harrelson went on to pursue a career path far beyond her mother's wildest dreams as she became a registered nurse focusing on helping people with chemical dependencies. And later, after the untimely death of her nephew, became an author of the book Lift Your Voice, How the Murder of My Nephew, George Perry Floyd, Changed the World. Angela says her world got bigger when she was given a bus ticket out of North Carolina to a small town in Iowa.
One of my older sisters asked me to come live with her in Iowa. And so that started my journey. First time I ever rode a bus. You know, first time I ever saw a ticket. And, you know, I just took like a little suitcase with maybe one or two pair of clothes in it. And I thought, oh my gosh, I felt like Dorothy. You know, Father Yelovich wrote, you know, I said, oh my goodness, I'm going. And mama was worried, but, you know, I was so adventurous. I've always had a creative mind and I was really, really, really smart. And she was really, really afraid to let me go, but she could see it in my eyes how much I wanted to go. And then my dreams that I would dream about on the swing, because if you read my book, the swing became my refuge. For pain and stuff and trying to figure things out. You know, we may not have a lot of money, I could always dream. And so when I got that chance to go on the Yellow Brick Road to Iowa, you know, so that's where I went. And that's where I just started. But then the fight just began.
You are beyond your mom's wildest dream, right? Because she was thinking that maybe you'd get a high school diploma.
I think I just turned either 19, I can't remember. You know, I graduated from high school and I still work in tobacco fields because that's all I knew. you know, trying to find a part-time jobs and just getting turned down because I didn't have anything. We graduated, but my mama didn't have the skill to say, okay, you need to talk to a guidance counselor. I didn't know what to say. They had them in school, but you know, all I knew is to graduate. I didn't understand the whole process and the concept. And even though I had older sisters around that helped the best they could, a lot of them were gone. It's like when you get grown, you got to find your own way. That was the thing. You got to find it. So in Iowa, like I said, that's when the fight would begin. Because I'm coming to a state, not everyone, hardly nobody looks like me in Iowa. I came from like a pretty much a predominant Black setting, been forced to integrate with white people, you know? And when I grew up, you talk to white people, but that's as far as it goes. When school was over, you didn't do hardly no hanging out. And that was just a normal rule that we followed.
Right, and you mentioned in your book, your mom knew some white women, and sometimes they were even friendly with her, and then
not in public. Oh, I remember when my mom considered that lady her best friend. They would, and I would see my mom leaning down the church. They were talking, they were laughing, and I'm looking at this like, wow, you know, I'm like, oh, that's a confirmation to me that it's okay to laugh and talk with them, even though. I rarely got that chance with them or anything like that living there. Honestly, I don't remember having a relationship with a white girl. Only, you know, laughing. But I remember my mama doing it. And it was like really, really good to see. But, you know, but my mama always knew her role in her place.
And so ultimately, we'll get you to Minneapolis because that's where, you know, that's where we all came to know your nephew in the very last minutes of his life. And I want you to help us shine a light on the rest of his life. Yeah. How do you end up in Minneapolis and how does he end up in Minneapolis?
Well, I was in Minneapolis first. Yes, I tell people that I came in 1998. And so, well, you know, the military, you know, that's when I came here for the military because I wanted to, they had a slot that I wanted to fill. It was in the Navy Reserve. And so let me go there because I was supposed to take a slot as an officer, but the recruiter messed up and said, well, you know what? You can always try something else to be an officer. You know what I'm saying? I said, but no, you told me if I took this slot that I would get my rank as an officer. So basically they lied. But guess what? I was stuck in the military, in the Navy.
Oh gosh.
So, you know, we said, so I, you know, you have a contract. So, but another door opened where the Air Force opened and they took me and said, you know what, we give you a doc because you're a registered nurse, you get a direct commission.
Great.
And all I had to do was go to officer training for 2 weeks. See, that's how the Lord, people don't know this, how it worked. Cause all I'm going through trying to get ahead and you know, and so that was the reason why I went there and continue my nursing career. And every year going to family reunions in Houston, Texas with my sister. Had a sister named Dahl Baby. She lived in Houston. Perry was in Houston. Sissy was still in his. That was the Houston family. So every year we went to the Thanksgiving dinner. We see everybody. It was nice. You know, there were times when deaths went there for a funeral. And so, you know, throughout all those years and stuff, me and Sissy were like tight. She and my buddy, you know, Sissy was buddy with me, but she was buddy with all the sisters. But
is Sissy the oldest of your sisters?
No, she's not the oldest of the sisters.
Okay.
Probably like down maybe, oh Lord, maybe the fifth. What? I hate getting
there's a lot to keep track of.
I know because our older sisters get mad at me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But she was a fifth or sixth round that line, you know. But we were tight. We talked. Me and Sissy talked almost every day. I helped a lot with her family, sending them money, trying to help her stuff with her kids and stuff. Because she had a handful, you know.
So tell me about, let's talk about her. Let's talk about George Floyd's mother or Perry's mother and kind of what her life looked like. What were the struggles that, you know, she was navigating? You mentioned she was a single mom.
Single mom. And Sissy just had a stroke of bad luck. It just seemed like one thing after another. But what happened, she dealt with children that had that fell into challenges with sobriety. Her oldest child fell to victim to sobriety. She got hooked on crack a lot.
Okay.
Crack, that substance. So did her second child. So she had three kids that she was dealing with it. And so her oldest child had a lot of children. She was taking drugs while she had these children.
Got it.
And my sister was determined to raise those kids. Mm. She had like six of them. Plus she had her own. And plus she had her son, Perry.
Did Perry's father struggle, did you say in the book, with substance?
With addiction too.
Okay.
So because she had these grandkids, trying to take care of all these kids, dealing with a daughter with that, it was hard for her to get ahead because my sister did not had the power and the strength to say no. Because she didn't understand it. She didn't understand what she was in a family disease. She had no insight to that whatsoever. She just knew she had to rescue her grandkids. She didn't have the strength to rescue her daughter, but God mind, she gonna rescue her grandkids so they could be somebody. Mm-hmm. And she did a phenomenal job with most of them. She did. She did the therapy, she did the treatment, you know, and a lot of them ace. But her, you know, and so she, you know, she just had a lot of obstacles to climb through. And Sissy, she ended up staying in the projects in Houston as she aged and got older. And she became the granny of the projects. Now she's dealt with a lot of people that she babysitted for. A lot of them probably took advantage of her kindness and weakness, but she became known to someone who had a really kind and good heart.
And where does Perry come in the pecking order of her children? What, like, where does he, how many siblings does he have altogether? And kind of what is his kind of childhood? Five?
Five. But the first three was the one that I knew well.
Okay. Ms.
Jaja and Tanya, who Tanya called me last night. George Forces Latonya called me last night, and I love you. You know, I'm like, okay, Tanya, I love you too, you know.
Nice.
And then Jaja, those are the first three that we all knew. And those are the ones that we were very close to. You know, that the family knew, that sing together. Matter of fact, George Floyd's sister Latonya lived with us her teenage years. She practically grew up and lived with us. You know, and Perry was the youngest of the three at the time.
Okay.
And that's when I first met Perry, when she brought him home for mama to see and to meet. He was about like 5 years old. And that's when we got to know Perry.
Okay. Who was the 5-year-old Perry that you got to know?
The 5-year-old Perry. Remember, I'm 12 years older than him. So I'm looking at, well, who is this little boy? I'm a teenager. I'm trying to learn how to be a cheerleader. I'm trying to learn dance routines. But then this 5-year-old boy is running around. I'm trying to figure him out, you know? And he's trying to figure us out. Like, who are we? Well, he was so playful. And he looked like to me, he looked like my favorite TV show, Flip Wilson. And Flip was, I always talk about that, because he really, really did back in that day, you know? And we used to like tease him, like, put a mop on your head and do that saying, what you see is what you get. You know, Flip Wilson, he was a quiet kid, but he was a humble kid. Because here we are, we're still using the outhouse. We still have the old broken down house. But Perry didn't think nothing about it. He'll stand on that little tree stump that we've been had and try to help him pump that little water. You know what I'm saying? You know, use little muscles to pump the water. He ran around and played. He didn't think nothing about it. Stop. And I look back up, I'm like, wow. And little, you know, and when he came to Minneapolis, it was May 17th, 2017.
Okay.
He came in May, but May 17th, 2017, when I first got my first telephone call from him, I checked my text at my Facebook, and I was reading some of the text messages, and something tell me, when was the first time that you talked? It was May 17, 2017.
by then, he had already had some of his own struggles with.
Oh, yes. I kind of like jumping ahead of the game. But, you know, like I had to tell this story about my sister, her heart struggle.
Yeah.
She didn't have health problems with her heart. And I think everything with the stress took a toll on her. And Perry was great in sports. He had opportunities to excel. And I think because of my sister and the struggle, that was hard for him to see, to think about dreaming again. See, well, I was dreaming again and pushing through. I just kept chipping off the block, kept doing it. I had my father around and both my parents around. You know, think it different. Even though we were broke and poor, it wasn't a drug-infested environment. You know, we didn't have those obstacles. His situation was a different, no father around. And he had these dreams. And my sister lives still living in this broke down project neighborhoods. And he wanted to help her. So he would go back and forth to help her. And I think, I'm just going by what some of the stuff my sister said, because she knows her child better than I do. You know, I think he wanted to make fast money is how he got involved with drugs. I don't think he meant to get addicted to drugs. I don't think he even fathomed going to prison. I just think he was trying to start it off making quick money. Hey, this is a quick money I can make, take care of my sister, and try to hop back to college. But what ended up happening, he ended up getting caught. He was doing the wrong things for the right reasons.
He comes to Minneapolis hoping to start a new life and
sobriety. Right. Well, what happened, he had met a pastor from Minnesota that was connected with some type of pastor in Houston. So when Perry got out of prison, he started doing a lot of outreach work, is what my sister was telling me. And he would like work with pastors, work with the community. It was still in him to help. He was all about community. He was like a ghetto superstar. But now, because he had prison, now he had street cred. But it wasn't in him to do all that stuff. It just wasn't. And I think the pastors and things could see that. And he joined church with my sister. Him and my sister were in a wheelchair, and they went to church together. And my sister was so happy and so excited. And so she told him that I was here. So my sister didn't tell me he was here yet. She called me and said, you know, Perry's here. I said, Perry, are you sure? When does this happen? And I was so excited. Oh, I was like a kid in the candy store. Because it was for the first time I've had a close relative to me. Not a distant relative. Really a distant cousin or somebody, but someone that was my sister's or my sister's and brother's children.
Your nephew, yeah.
And I felt so happy. And when I got the first phone call, I said, yes, Perry. And you know what he told me? He said, Auntie, I remember you doing cheerleader practice. I said, what? I didn't know that at the time because, you know, when he was growing up, I'm thinking, who is this little boy? I don't want him. We cheerleader practice. I don't really have time for him. You know what I'm saying? That 16-year-old mentality. But little did I know, he was watching me do my cheerleader practices. I said, you were? He said, yeah. He said, you were good. I said, I had no idea. He said, no. He said, I used to love to watch you guys practice. And practice. He said, y'all, you know, do the cartwheels. He said, y'all did really good. I was just tickled by that.
That's sweet. And he had been an athlete and a good athlete, right?
He was a top of the line.
Tell me about the sports he played.
Football and basketball.
Mm-hmm.
He could have been an all-star, you know. You know, Perry, you know, in second grade, he wanted to be a Supreme Court judge. He was a big dreamer, too.
So what if he'd had somebody, you know, you have this internal light and drive that it's a gift and this deep, deep sense of resiliency. And you yourself had to go through so much work to get to where you are. What if somebody like Perry, who we all know, the outside world knows as George Floyd, what if he'd had an amazing guidance counselor or a teacher at school who said, you know what? I see you. You're going to make it. How might his path have been different?
I think it would have turned him around a lot because the only thing that he was missing was that consistent male mentor. in his life. Like someone he can say, hey, stick with me throughout, thick and thin, ride or die. You know, yeah, you have your buddies, your close friends, but do you have someone that is going to look out for your best interests and say, you know what, you're heading the wrong way. Let's steer. Everybody needs that sometimes, especially men, because even though I'm his aunt, I could never teach him how to be a man. And Perry always knew in the back of his mind that his father was living. And he knew that we called his father Perry too. And so that's why he wanted to be George. He didn't want to be called Perry. He wanted to be called George around certain people. He didn't mind the family, you know. And I think I think that messed with him, not the father. I remember when he first met his father as a teenager. And we were all sitting in the car. Perry came to see for a concert. It was a concert. My mother played at church. Beautiful music. Sissy was in the car. Perry's in the car. Mama's in the car. I forgot who was driving the car. And this man walked up and it was Perry Sr. And he knocked on the window. But Perry Jr. didn't know who he was. Mm-hmm. And he said, hi, Sister Sissy, you know, and I'm sitting there like quiet, you know, like I did a little high, but I didn't know what to do. And he looked at Perry, he said, I'm your father. And my heart just dropped. And Perry looked at him. He didn't say nothing. He didn't say anything.
Did he ever talk to you about that?
No, but I want to talk to him about that because that was a missed opportunity. Not for Perry, because it was a missed opportunity for him. But it wasn't his fault because he didn't know. He wasn't prepared for that because his father hadn't been around that much. But gosh, it was a missed opportunity for his dad to say, you know what? I love you. Let's take it here. But yeah. You know, when you aren't taught these skills and you don't have it in your life, it's hard.
Yeah.
But I wish that it could have got to that level where I could have talked about his dad. Or even his uncles could have went there with him.
Is his dad still alive today?
No, he died before his mom did. Okay. He had an aneurysm.
So George Perry Floyd, when he comes to Minneapolis, he's trying to get his feet on the ground. He's made some connections with pastors. You say, I'm here for you. You focus on your sobriety. We'll be in touch when we can, kind of thing, right?
Yeah, we sure. We talk, we FaceTime and all this stuff, you know, and we were always making all these plans. I said, Perry, you know what? You're working three jobs. Why don't you come work with me at the hospital? He said, I'm going to do that, auntie. He said, you know, I got to do this. I said, you run around too much.
And what were his three jobs?
He worked at the Salvation Army. He worked at it was security, a bouncer. And there was one more place he was working at. And I thought it was too much. Because he had his own place to live at. He had a roommate, his own place to live at. He worked second shift. He worked, one of them was second shift, and then he had to be the day program. And then he went to church every time.
He had gotten a hold of his sobriety for a chunk of time while he was there. Is that right?
Yes. He really, truly was. I mean, he was proud. He talked straight. He talked sober. He was in and out. He was straight. You know, my brother came up from South Dakota. I said, Perry's here. He went to go visit Perry. Another family member was there, so excited. He went to go visit him. You know, Perry worked out all the time. You know, stamina, fit, like really, really fit. You know, 6'7", muscular, fit. Yeah. And the speed stuff up forwards, I got a call. My sister was really sick, and she was put on, like almost a year later, close to a year on hospice. And I'm like, oh my God. So I said, Lord, I didn't realize how sick she was, but her heart was failing. And it got to the point where I said, well, have you told Perry yet? She said, no. I said, what do you want him to do? She said, I don't want him to come back. I said, oh Lord. I said, that's something you need to tell him. So I called Perry. I said, your mom is sick. She said, well, does she want me to come home? I said, won't you call him? Because, you know, I'd rather for him to hear that. And so he called her and she told him, I want you to stay where you are. He was kind of hurt by it because he wanted me to come. I'm going to be honest with you. Because he wanted to be there, the oldest son. But I knew her reasons.
His sobriety, correct?
It was more important for her to see him sober. And knowing, I want to cry sometimes, trying not to cry. And knowing that he was doing something good. She wanted an image not in her mind, but in her heart before she passed.
Yeah.
Because she said, I just want to see him in a good place before I leave. That was the message.
And then she passed away when?
So Perry was killed 2020, so I think around 2018. It was just really hard because we were so, I talked to Cece every day, but I know it was harder for him. And I remember telling Perry that she passed away. And, you know, because I wanted us to go together. But he said, no, I'm going to drive. I said, don't drive. And he said, well, then I have someone drive with you. I said, well, I can't drive because I have to be back to work. But I said, I'll meet you there. So we did. And when I saw him, he had lost a lot of weight. And I believe he really relapsed. But I didn't want to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
My intuition and my experience.
Yeah.
Was telling me differently. And I remember hugging Perry. He was so glad to see me. And we was just hugging. I said, I'm so glad that you're here. And I told him it's going to be all right. But I looked in his eyes and it wasn't the same. That spirit wasn't there.
Yeah. So he'd relapsed by then.
I think so.
George Perry Floyd's mother died on May 30th, 2018 in Houston, Texas. He wasn't able to see her before she passed, but when he would die less than 2 years later, under the knee of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, he called for her. While Angela Harrelson thinks all of the videos are damning and hard to watch, there's one that stands out in her mind.
He was really into his spiritual, and he believed in God. But during the arrest of Derek Chauvin, there was just so many videos shown. And so many videos you guys got to see, some you didn't see. But there was one video that someone showed me, and I wish I knew, I wish I'd have kept that video, where he was telling someone, I am a man of God. And he confessed that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when he did that, I think God heard his prayer from heaven. And I think because the way he said that, there was so much pain, but he wanted them to know who I represent. And I think because of that, he stood in his faith. Even though he's in pain, even though I felt like I was going to die, even though this is going on, I'm a man of God.
Yeah.
And he heard his prayer for heaven. And that's how the world was able to change.
I was thinking, as you're sharing this, it kind of comes full circle. So he doesn't get to see her. And then in his last minutes of life, as he's trying desperately to fight for air, he's calling for his mama. And how does that impact you?
When he said that he didn't get to see his mother when she was really, really, I mean, he saw a lot, but I'm saying the time he wanted to see her before she passed, learning that she wasn't doing that well. She didn't want him to see him. This is what I think. She wanted to see him is doing good. She, in her mind, that you're somewhere, you're not here, where people can pull you back. That was important to her. I also think when he yelled out for mama, he saw her. He had a chance to see her. And she just said, come.
And now they're together.
And now they're together. We couldn't see it, but he could. They could see each other. And I believe that.
I believe it too. Powerful and tragic. And then there's this little bit of, like, in the midst of this tragedy that I can see another way of looking at it, which is what we have to hold on to, I think, to cope. Yeah, right?
We hold on to, you know, I think about, I never met my great-grandfather, Henry Thomas Stewart Sr. And he was raised up in a time where he was born a slave. And by the time he was 21, he had accumulated over 500 acres of land. We lost all of that because he was uneducated. They say the white man, white supremacy, stole it from him. You know, he didn't have educated. He didn't know how to read and write. But he knew how to work hard.
Yeah.
So, you know, we tried to get some of the land back, but wasn't able to do that. But I do feel that up in heaven, my great-grandfather there did the best he could. He passed his traits down to the family. And when he's up there with Perry.
Yeah, everybody's together up there.
Everybody's together. He said, you know, and I'm thinking, he said, you did it. He said, you opened that door, you did it.
Bring us to now. So in May 2020, we all watched a public lynching of your nephew, unfortunately. And I was in Minneapolis in November 2022. And in December 2022, it was very cold and people are out there. Nobody's forgetting. His face is everywhere, not only in Minnesota, but everywhere. And there's this narrative in places like the Bay Area where, like, oh, people in Minnesota are nice, but they're not activists. But I can tell you that's not true. And you could tell us that. So tell us what's happening there. What's going to happen with the George Floyd Global Memorial? And how do we keep his legacy alive? How are you going to continue doing your work?
We keep it in people's faces. They cannot deny us. Denial is not even part of the process anymore. You know, we always want the awareness and the validation that, hey, this stuff is real and it is happening. And we will not forget, and we won't let you forget. So we still hold space out there in the George Floyd Square. They have activists there. They have meetings twice a day. They keep the spirit alive. We do events out there. They still hold community organizations. Their space is now sacred, and they keep it sacred. We do pilgrimage for people all around the world. Pilgrimage is like taking another word for tour, but they say pilgrimage to keep it safe. We do exhibitions, and we take some of, because George Floyd Global Memorial is an art institute. What we did over the last 3 years, we have accumulated over 5,000 pieces of artwork from around the world that people lay to rest in honor of George Floyd. From pictures, from paintings, to writings, to poems, to songs, the records, to anything people want to do to lay. And so we work with archivists, people who work specialized in preservations, to show us how to do that. And they volunteer their time and to help us with that. And so we're able to do exhibitions now for people and businesses must to come out and do them, which help keep the name alive. And people are very excited about it. Now we have a current exhibition at the Health Partners Hospital here that we have. We've done it at Orchestra Hall. We've done it at businesses. And we hope to expand that throughout our journey. We hire internships to help us do archivists. We call them archivists. They help us with that. We're now doing open up for showing people how to do entrepreneurship that we have joined with, I think it's an organization called HOPE, and they're going to be helping us with set up entrepreneur, how to do that, what to do, how to fill out LLC, all things like that. We're doing that. We do Rise and Remember, which is a huge event that we do every single year. 8,000 to 10,000 people show up. We offer live music and food to the community. We have a great time. National artists come and help us out. This year we're at the conference, and this is our second year gala that's going to be the place of which the gala is going to be taking place at Paisley Park.
On
May 26th is the gala. May 25th is the kind of like vigil, and May 27th is a huge festival.
I want to come. I'm going to do my very best. You know, we're talking about how deeply embedded, you know, white supremacy is and racism and all of these things. And there's multiple tiers that we can see. We're seeing, as you've said, you know, the way in which people are labeled when they're struggling with addiction, depending on the racial identity. It could be from addict with an illness to criminal. So what do we need to change structurally around that narrative? And how do we get to a place where police are no longer killing Black and brown people?
Oh, my goodness.
You have it figured out, Angela?
Do I have it? You know what? The whole thing is that is happening. It's you're talking about a 400-year system that people work really, really hard at keeping in place. But here's the good thing about it. Change is here. There are people that are working diligent every single day, white, Black, around the clock, sacrificing their time, sometimes their life. And yo, it doesn't look like it's here overnight, but the change is here. And that's what I'm excited about. You know, it feels good to go to a place and see diversity. Someone look like me. It feels so good to see these kids playing with all types of people. You know, there are so many times they had to walk in the classroom and I'd be the only Black person. Very rarely do a white child walk in and be the only white person in the Black class or in the Black school.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But we're expected to accept that. But it's so good to see this diversity happening. You know, it's like, wow, this is what God wants. We're all God's children. So yes, it sometimes seems like we're going two steps backwards when we see more police killings. But I always try to tell people, we are seeing a lot now because of the cameras and the videos. What about all the killings that have taken place when there was not cameras and videos? What we are seeing is just the tip of the iceberg. There are screaming graves and people yelling, blood on people's hands that we would never know about. But what we see now, we are speaking for those people that can't speak for themselves. So it is happening. And the most important thing that people need to know that we are going forward. Laws are being changed. Laws are happening. This is exciting. And I have to say this because otherwise people don't think change is here. It is here. There are laws that have been changed to help us. No, we still waiting for the George Floyd Policing Act, but I believe it's going to happen. I'm a dreamer. I never stop dreaming. The vision is what gives me a hope. Hope with a plan is what we have. Hope with a plan now. We just don't have hope. There's hope with a plan that our people are working. And my dream is one day is that I don't have to hold a sign that says Black Lives Matter. The movement is not about that 50 years from now, we're still holding the sign that says Black Lives Matter. When we don't have to hold a sign that says Black Lives Matter, that's sharing when we know that we have arrived.
I think maybe when we spoke informally in the coffee shop, I asked you about this, but what would you say the most important lesson that you've learned from this? I don't even know. Like, it's such a rich, action-packed life of resiliency and so many tests and trials and tribulations you've had along the way. What would you say the most important lesson would be?
When someone say no to you, don't consider it a rejection. Look at it as an option, and you take control of that option. That's the important lesson I learned of all of this. No is just another option. It's up to me if I want to accept it.
That's beautiful. And if people want to follow you or stay in touch with you and your work, how would they find you?
Oh, I'm on Instagram. Follow on Instagram, Angela.Harrelson. You can always find me at the square, the George Floyd Square. But what I want the audience to know that what has happened to my nephew, I felt their love and their support. And Lord knows I appreciate it. It is an unfortunate gift. Is how I sum this up. Unfortunate that I lost Perry, his daughter lost her father, the family lost, we lost a family member. The community lost someone that they were just getting to know. But what he left is his gift to use your voice.
Thank you so much for being with me today. And just a reminder, Angela's book is called Lift Your Voice, How My Nephew George Floyd's Murder Changed the World. And it's ghostwritten by Michael Levin, along with you, Angela Harrelson. I hope everybody reads it. Everybody should.
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you so much. You're wonderful. You're wonderful.
Likewise. I can't wait to see you again very soon.
See you soon.
All right, beautiful. Thank you so much, Angela.
Even if you can't make it to Minneapolis to visit George Floyd Square, you can see Angela Harrelson right here in the Bay Area, as she'll be at Town Hall Theater in Lafayette on Monday night at 7 p.m. Tickets are available online on a pay-what-you-can basis at townhalltheater.com. A special thank you to Laura Zucker for providing music for today's special program, to my daughters, Espy and Delilah, and to the fellow single moms out there who are doing our best to move forward while keeping our children afloat. I'll end with a quote of Audre Lorde, who says, "There's no such thing as a single struggle issue because we do not live single issue lives." So in the words of Viola Hall's mother, do what you can, when you can, while you can. I'm Sharon Sabota. Happy belated International Women's Day.
Well, this old face has seen a few days of blazing red joy, days of blue. Every line etched in deep by sand that slipped through, not mine to keep. We are tidy daffodils in the careful gardens we all till, but when clover muscles through soft green tangle makes the garden new. This life's a chaos colored tapestry, upside down, inside out, permanent, imperfect, wild, untidy thing. I'll live my just still. Shrinking from risk, what did I miss? Have I really lived at all? There are times I will regret. Places not seen, friends not met.